Pride Month, and it's complicated. We have an administration that is increasingly hostile toward queer people, and even within the queer community, there are still some very real tensions. But nonetheless, queer people are still celebrating themselves and each other and finding joy and solidarity, especially when times feel tough. So where is everyone gathering? The corporate pride events are only getting cornier. City-sponsored parades are getting shorter. And the $80 per ticket Pride Month raves are not for everybody. The way that queer people congregate has changed dramatically. And with the rise of social media and the apps, queer people are finding new spaces to gather. Third spaces that are connecting people who are sometimes the only or first in their areas. So this Pride Month, we're taking a loving step outside the bar and into the queer diners, bookstores, knitting groups, tennis clubs, choirs, and all the other places where people are finding community. To talk about those spaces and where to find them, I'm here with Eric Kiepenberg, author of Dining Out, First Dates, Defiant Nights, and Last Call Disco Fries at America's Gay Restaurants, and Lucas Hildebrand, author of The Bars Are Ours, Histories and Cultures of Gay Bars in America, 1960 and After. Lucas, welcome to It's Been a Minute, and Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So happy to have you both. Hello, hello. I'm Brittany Luce, and you're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR, a show about what's going on in culture and why it doesn't happen by accident. And a reminder, if you love It's Been a Minute, which from the sweet comments y'all have been leaving, it sounds like maybe you do, be sure to follow or subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app. That way you get new episodes the moment they drop. Do you have a favorite queer third space, and why is it your favorite? Lucas, we'll start with you.
My answer is going to be somewhat historical because I think many of these spaces don't exist anymore, but they've existed at different points in history. And for me, I think the first queer third space that comes to my mind that formed me in a certain way was a queer coffee shop in Minneapolis in the 1990s called Cafe Weird, which was part of a phenomenon that was actually very prevalent in the 90s, but that my students today often don't know ever existed. And that's the gay coffee shop.
That was big in the 90s, you say?
It was big in the 90s. There were almost every major city had at least one, if not multiple, queer coffee shops. And sometimes they catered to a particular segment of the community, and sometimes they were much more open. So Minneapolis in the 1990s had two of them. One was Cafe Weird, which was really an inclusive space for all elements and all ages of the queer community. And the other one was the Blue Moon, which was primarily a lesbian or women's coffee shop.
I love that. And what about you, Eric? What is your favorite queer third space?
I am a diner gay. I have been going to diners since I was way in the closet back in high school. And I would rather be at no other type of restaurant than at a diner after the bars and clubs closed at 2 a.m. when everyone's a little tipsy and still a little feeling frisky and you want to have some pancakes and eggs and keep the night going. That is my kind of a space. And diners have, for a very, very long time, served the gay communities in ways that I think are just really special because diners are very singular. And what I mean by that is there's something for everybody, from vegans to carnivores. They're usually open 24 hours a day. And a lot of the diners in my book were very close to gay clubs and restaurants in gay neighborhoods. So I guess I would say just take me to a diner. I can get a grilled cheese and some rice pudding, and I am a happy gay.
Great combo. Great combo. Great combo. Oh my gosh, it's bringing back memories of going to a gay club called Spiral with my friends in Lansing, Michigan. And then a couple times after, we're going to a diner called Theo's, which I think also might be closed in Lansing, Michigan. Good times. Good times. Good times. Both of you have been all over the country looking at queer spaces, from bars and pubs to restaurants and diners. You've both spoken about the vitality of queer spaces outside of the big queer hubs like New York and Atlanta and San Francisco. I'm wondering, what makes these spaces unique?
I think what makes a gay restaurant or gay restaurants special and different from gay bars is that you can do things there that you really can't or shouldn't do at a gay bar. I always use the example of you can go to a restaurant and you can have a breakup and you can cry and you can be sad and you don't want to be the queen in the corner at the club crying, you know, but you can do that at a restaurant because generally it's the kind of place where you can have a conversation to just keep talking about crying, you know, during the AIDS crisis. Restaurants were makeshift chapels and had memorial services for people who died. At the same time, restaurants are places where you can be a teenager and you're too young to get into a bar or a nightclub, but you can hang out at a gay diner with your friends. On the flip side, you can be an elder and the music at the clubs is too loud and it's too expensive and you feel invisible at a gay bar or a gay club, but at a gay restaurant, you can feel seen. And to be able to be seen in a gay space in ways that you may not be anymore at a gay bar, I think is very, very special. Gay restaurants have always been places where the gay community has mobilized. During the AIDS crisis, ACT UP had a favorite restaurant or two that they met at to keep the activism going because their friends were dying. So for these and many other reasons, I think gay restaurants are just very different from gay bars and I think need to be appreciated in ways that I think as a community we really haven't.
I'd love to hear from you on this, Lucas. Like, what do you think about, like, specifically the vitality of these, like, queer spaces? Bars, yes, but also bars in places maybe where the queer community isn't as big as it is in some place like New York or Los Angeles or San Francisco.
Yeah. So when you look at a city like New York or San Francisco or Chicago or LA, the bigger the city and the more different venues there are, the more they either compartmentalize and sort of segment the community into very particular niches within the community. So they're not actually serving a broader community, or they tend to compete for the same affluent white gay male dollar.
Clientele.
So there's a way in which, sort of ironically, the more sort of queer and inclusive and expansive spaces are often not on the coast, or they're not in the biggest cities, but they exist in other spaces. So I think the most dynamic spaces I encountered in my research were often in Texas, northern Wisconsin, places that maybe we don't think of as being where these things exist. Kansas City is where I saw the best drag show I've ever seen in my life. And so it was really important in my work to think beyond the coasts, but also to start the project in the middle of the country, because queerness exists and thrives and sort of needs to find a physical space for community in those places.
I wonder, what do you think happens in some of these smaller queer spaces that doesn't happen anywhere else?
Well, I think a couple of different things are happening. So on the one hand, there's not the sense of competition. And so they can be truly for everyone or everyone who wants to be in these spaces, in these locations. Mm-hmm. But they also often don't have to follow a template. And so there's a kind of a local culture or a localness that can manifest its own vision of what queerness is.
That's really interesting. I mean, it even makes me think about something I feel like that I've seen across the board. It's just in nightlife more broadly, which is kind of this homogenization, I think, of how different bars or restaurants can look across the country. It can be hard sometimes to find something harder now, I think, maybe than it was 10 or 15 years ago, to find a bar or restaurant that feels like it is not trying to sort of like target some generic idea of who a customer is. And I feel like part of that has to do with social media and the internet and sort of creating expectations that maybe customers or even business owners feel should be maintained across different locale. This makes me wonder, how have you seen the internet change the culture of the spaces that you used to go to? Or maybe even some of the places that came up in your research. Eric, let's hear from you first.
Yeah, I think what the internet has done is really fantastic. I mean, the idea that, look, I'm a Gen Xer, and if you had told me when I was coming of age in, you know, still in the closet in Cleveland, Ohio, that in 2026 we would have all these options for where to go, I would have said that you were absolutely nuts. But I think that that access to gay culture has really expanded people's sense of what it means to gather as gay people. But I agree with you in that it has also homogenized a lot of things. I'm thinking specifically of drag brunch. I mean, for the most part, drag brunch, no matter where you go, it's kind of the same thing. And that's not bad. Drag queens are getting work. Restaurants are selling out their seatings. Like, that's all great. But at the same time, as drag brunch becomes something that you sort of see on social media, and the expectation is that it's going to be the same every time and not as gay as it used to be, what does that mean for us as a community? What does that mean for drag artists? And so I think there is something missing from the drag brunches that I used to go to. Do I go to drag brunch? Absolutely.
Lucas, what about you? How have you seen the internet change the culture of the spaces that you used to go to, or maybe even some of the places that came up in your research for your book?
So the internet has definitely expanded the ways in which people can sort of figure out who they are, imagine a gay life, sort of come to terms with their identity, and make those kinds of connections. And I think that's been profoundly meaningful for so many people. I think what it's changed in terms of a community feel is that it sort of replaced what had historically been a very in-person embodied experience. And so you had to actually go to brick and mortar spaces to find people and to navigate oftentimes a lot of friction interpersonally, or sort of risk sort of face-to-face rejection, or sort of have the serendipity of seeing or meeting someone that you couldn't have met any other way. Mm-hmm. And it gives you an embodied sense of feeling part of a community, which I think is different than a virtual experience. And I think that, you know, in many ways, both are really essential, but it's a fundamental paradigm change in terms of how people are sort of figuring out who they are, what they're into, and their sense of what it means to belong to a community. And I think that's been the biggest cultural change. In terms of doing the kind of work that I was doing in terms of research, one of the things that we see is that with largely the loss of a gay press, which was largely sustained through advertising from different gay bars and listing bar events and pictures from bars, is when that moves to social media, when Instagram becomes the primary way to sort of signal what bars exist and what's happening at them, it's A, we lose a lot of the historical trace of these spaces when social media accounts become ephemeral. But also, if you're new to a city and trying to figure out how to navigate it, one of the things I learned again and again is Yelp is not a very good way to figure out which are the good gay bars, because it's mostly straight people rating the gay bars. And so in a weird way, there's both more access, but it can be harder to figure out sort of where's the place for you if the algorithm doesn't know what you're looking for.
Also, too, I mean, going out and being around people is a muscle, right? And something we talked about in the show in the past is how you can really fall out of practice of communicating with people. Like, I think back to when I was younger, and my friends and I were, I think, a lot more willing to take a gamble on like, okay, maybe this won't be the funnest place in the world, but we can make it fun, or we can leave and go someplace that we know that we like. There was a lot less, I think, riding on having a good time. It was sort of like, we'll see what it's like. And then if we have a great time, great. And if we don't, then we learned something. But I'd love to hear from you on this, Eric. I mean, you were last on It's Been a Minute to talk about your book, Dining Out, which talks about all manner of queer restaurants, diners, and other hangout spots. I'm wondering, what is the unique value of being together physically in a space and breaking bread?
Meals have a big effect on people. I think being at a bar is great. There's drinks, there's music, there's drugs, there's whatever's happening in the bathroom. I mean, there's all kinds of great things that happen there. But at a restaurant, for me, I think the value is being able to have conversations with other people in ways that you don't have to shout, you don't have to be drunk. You know, the music is low. Look, crazy things have also happened at restaurants, but gathering over food is something very, very singular. And I think at gay restaurants, when you look around and you are with your people, I think it's also really, really meaningful. And Also, I have to say, one of my favorite memories of going out to the, maybe this is a Cleveland thing, but man, fist fights at gay bars. I have never seen queens go at it quite before, you know, back in the 90s, you know. And if everything is so curated these days, I just wonder if we're missing some of those chance encounters that are just part of, you know, being gay and growing up and understanding who you are.
Ah, that is such an interesting point and so central to like the spontaneity of nightlife. Is like, you don't know, are people gonna make out? Right. Are they gonna exchange numbers? Are they gonna fight? Like, all of those things can happen at the let out. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
And that's why you want to stick around until lights come up.
That's
everybody
right.
Goes outside and then you just see what happens. It's a good thing. It's
that's
a good
right.
Thing.
Yeah.
And then you have what's called the sidewalk sale. After last call, you're on the sidewalk and you figure out who to go home with.
Exactly. Coming up after the break.
And I think one of the things that's really important to remember is that a safe space for one person may be an unsafe space for another person.
Stick around. I want to talk about how our culture thinks about the term safe space. I think of it as much more associated with schools, maybe like higher education, like where students felt comfortable enough to express their gender or sexuality, for instance. These could be online, they could be in real life, they could be a classroom or with a certain friend group or whatever. But over time, this idea has sort of spread to even adult queer spaces like bars, drag shows, ballroom, etc. Lucas, your book points specifically at how safety was often precarious at best in these spaces. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, so I think that as we were talking about, these are always spaces in which you're going to be open to experiences, but you can't predict what's going to happen in them. And those experiences can be like life-changing and euphoric, or they can be terrible and traumatic, or they can be everything all at once. And so historically, these queer spaces were subject to police raids, to street violence. You know, we've had sort of very heart-wrenching reminders of that, both with Pulse and with the shooting in Colorado Springs, that sometimes sort of spaces where queer people come together make them visible for hate crimes and for other kinds of violence and for harassment. But I do think different generations have different expectations of what a safe space is. And so I think for my generation, I'm Generation X as well, growing up through these spaces and becoming a queer adult in these spaces and via these spaces meant that you understood that you're going to have some bad experiences in these spaces, but these spaces are a framework that protects your ability to explore and to have experiences. And it's not about being protected from experience. It's about going to these spaces for those experiences. And I think one of the things that is culturally different, and this may or may not relate to growing up with social media and this idea of a curated or sort of very safe sense of managing sort of what how one interacts with other people. Oftentimes, sort of a younger generation, even sort of myself, as I go out less and less, like I have less patience for other people, and sort of those moments of friction, annoyance, conflict, whatever, become more challenging because we're so used to interacting virtually that we forget what it's like to be in a space with other people. And there's this idea of a safe space that, from my perspective, is fairly sanitized, but also sort of doesn't allow for the messiness of human interaction, which is not to say that everything in these spaces that happens is okay, but figuring out sort of how to be in spaces with other people. How do you share a dance floor with other people? How do you sort of make space for others while sort of having, you know, the space that you need for yourself?
Huh. It's interesting. I mean, it sounds like what people are looking for is not necessarily safety, I think, in the very broad American sense of like thinking first and foremost about where are all of the exits? Right. Is there armed security person at the front door? Are we going through metal detectors and going through purses and that sort of thing, like that sort of capital S safety. But more so, maintaining places where people can experiment with their look, with their identity, with how they want to dress, how they want to move, who they might want to talk to, where you can experiment and you're not going to be pushed out or you're not going to be sort of cast out or judged in such a way that like no one wants you to come back. Could you talk to me some more about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, these spaces have always been spaces in which there is a sort of duality of both a sense of liberation and safety and the ability to be a queer person in space, but they always exist in tension with interpersonal frictions, whether that is romantic rejection, mm-hmm. whether that is sort of social bias, structural racism, yeah. sexism, transphobia, all of those things coexist in these spaces. And I think one of the things that's really important to remember is that a safe space for one person may be an unsafe space for another person. And I grew up in this kind of second golden age of queer spaces. And I think we are looking at a moment now with a political turn and a kind of reactionary retreat from a sense of political or physical safety in the U.S., that these spaces are going to become important again. And I fear or am concerned that we have a younger generation of queer people who doesn't have these spaces or don't know what they can be for them.
The first thing that I thought of when you said safe spaces was actually something that Lucas said, which I thought was so smart, was that it means different things depending on who you are, also what generation. And I think for many years in our community, it was the gay bar was the safe space. Now, I think there are lots of places that could be considered safe that aren't necessarily gay. It could be the local IHOP. It could be the local Starbucks. If you're in a small town, you know that you will be safe at those spaces, even though outwardly they may not look like gay venues.
You know, in some towns where, you know, queer folks are left with one or two queer-friendly businesses, I mean, many people still might feel excluded, you know, because of racism or transphobia, for instance. It can sometimes be difficult for patrons to feel like they have the power to really change the culture of a space. Yeah. How can we push our local businesses to do better?
That's a really challenging question, but it's an important question. So one of the strategies we've seen is reimagining a way from a full-time brick-and-mortar venue to the logic of the pop-up or the party. And the temporariness of it is something that sort of you don't have to make the overhead of the rent, but you can still create a space or an event that is more responsive and to the community with less need for sort of capital expenditure. So that's one of the things that we've seen. But oftentimes that exists in negotiation with or in collaboration with sort of full-time venues.
Parties or pop-ups. What about you, Eric? Have you seen anything that's worked? Like, what are your thoughts on this?
I have. You know, there's this wonderful bar that serves cheese curds in Green Bay, Wisconsin, called Napolese, and they have this wonderful trans mixer every month where people from all over the region come to live their true trans selves over a glass of beer and cheese curds. And that was because a trans woman named Martha asked, could we do this at your venue? It's just one time a month. Can we do this? And the answer was yes. And when I went, there were people from other parts of the country who had traveled to Green Bay, Wisconsin to be a part of this trans night. So I think in some cases, it can be just a sense of, can we do this at your bar? And a lot of the times, at least in the places that I visited, the answer has been yes. I guess for a more recent example, there's a Bear Burger in Hell's Kitchen that recently just turned into sort of a gay restaurant for Pride.
Oh, cool.
And their ads now are just like big, hairy bears and Speedos.
I literally know the exact location you're talking about now that I think about it. I'm like, oh, yeah, I know exactly what he's talking about.
Yes, now we're talking.
But I think a lot of these venues are really hungry to be relevant and to serve the community. And so it is this question of just approaching the venue and saying, can we do a night? Can we try something? And I think most of the time they're going to be open to it because they want to survive and they want to build their audience as well. And oftentimes they'll say yes.
This has been such a great conversation. Many people in my life have been celebrating already since late May. So before even the clock struck June, they've been celebrating since late May. But I think this is a conversation that is going to be meaningful for a lot of people, especially this month. So Eric, Lucas, thank you both so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much, and happy Pride.
Happy Pride, exactly.
Happy Pride.
Happy Pride. This episode of It's Been a Minute was produced by
Corey Antonio Rose.
This episode was edited by
Nina Patuk.
Engineering support came from
Sina Lafredo.
Our supervising producer is
Cher Vincent.
Our executive producer is
Barton Girdwood.
Our VP of programming is
Yolanda Sanguini.
All right, that's all for this episode of It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce. Talk soon.